Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, a senior security analyst at WatchGuard Threat Lab, and
I'm Corey Knockreiner, that CTO guy.
Each week on the podcast, we'll analyze the methods and techniques behind the latest attacks, hacks, and breaches. We'll tell you what happened, how the bad guys did it, and how to protect your business, employees, and customers. This week, the Wi-Fi Alliance released details on the new WPA3 wireless security standard. We'll break down what's new and how it will benefit you and the industry as a whole. Later in the episode, we'll discuss nation-state cyber attacks, including their origins and where they're heading now. Let's get started. All right, let's start with the news. So last week, the Wi-Fi Alliance finally published some more details about the upcoming WPA3 wireless security standard. Along with that, they actually published a few other docs with some other standards that are quite interesting and beneficial too that we'll get into. But if you remember, Corey, why do we need a WPA3 standard so quickly right now?
Well, I think everyone's probably heard of WPA2, which has been pretty good for a while. And in fact, going way back, you've heard of WPA1, back when we had WEP, I should say. And that was cracked long ago. If you're using WEP today, you're crazy. But then WPA2 came out, Wi-Fi Protected Access 2, and it's treated the industry for a long time pretty well.
Since 2004, right?
Yeah, since 2004. Not a ton of vulnerabilities initially in it. I think if you're using pre-shared keys with it, you could maybe capture some initial authentication traffic and use that to brute force passwords. But other than that kind of dictionary attack, there wasn't anything until the infamous crack attack.
Crack.
Yeah, everyone heard. What does crack stand for again? Key renegotiation attack?
Key reinstallation attack.
Oh, there we go. Reinstallation attack. Crack. So yeah, and that was an issue with kind of the four-way handshake that crack used. We won't dive into the technical details. We have a ton of Sekplicity content if you're interested. That has been patched. A lot of clients, our access points, by the way, have been patched. So you can get away with using WPA if you've patched the crack vulnerability. But I think that's kind of why the wireless privilege, the alliance wanted to create a more secure and updated version.
And to be fair, they've probably been working on this for quite some time, but I'm sure that definitely bumped up the schedule on it.
I think so, for sure.
So some of the things WPA3 does for the standard itself, it's deprecating TKIP. If you're not familiar, WPA2 actually supports two
T-tip.
Separate...
T-tip, is that like the Q-tip I use to clean my ears?
You know, that's exactly it. You got it. So there are two separate encryption protocols you could use. TKIP was kind of left over from the WEP WPA days as a legacy encryption method. The more secure AES, Advanced Encryption Standard method, was most popularly used, and that's now mandated in WPA3.
TKIP, so it's not new. WPA2 used AES, but it wasn't mandated. So this is kind of forcing the better encryption standard.
Exactly. And it adds protected management frames as another mandated standard, which was actually introduced into WPA2, I think back in like 2012 in an amendment, but now it's another mandated standard. And then on top of that, they actually make some more, I guess, more drastic changes to a few different modes.
Let's talk about that. I talked about the PSK. If you're not like an enterprise and you don't have an authentication associated with your Wi-Fi, you tend to use what they call pre-shared keys.
Yep. Probably
it's just
what you use in your house.
Exactly. Yep. Or a hotel guest network
FBI
or whatever.
FBI surveillance van.
Oh, yeah. Connect to those. They're fun. So, but that's gone now. That was a thing that was susceptible to dictionary attacks and brute forcing. So what's there now?
So to backtrack, what was the problem with pre-shared key was that the encryption key used for the connection was derived from that password that you use to connect to the network, which means that anyone that knows the password could get the encryption key for everyone's connections. And the way that it was negotiated, you can actually do that offline as well. So long as you capture some packets, you can then decrypt everything offline and steal everyone's data, basically. So replacing pre-shared key mode is now WPA3 personal. And it's going to mostly be used probably in the homes and hotels, things like that. But it offers quite a few new benefits. First off, it offers perfect forward security or secrecy, or however you wanted to say the
perfect
acronym.
Perfect forward secrecy.
Yes. And if you're not familiar with perfect forward secrecy, the General theory behind it is that if someone's able to get your key or password at a later date, they can't go back in time and decrypt all the traffic they've gathered from you previously. We won't go into the details on that because it gets to be pretty mathy, and mathy isn't very fun for a podcast.
I like maths. One plus four is 12.
I used to like math, and then I went to college.
So the other authentication method for WPA2 was a WPA2 Enterprise, and I think that still exists, but does that have updates as well?
Yep, and it's not very drastically changed. They add a few more options in terms of encryption. So now you can go up to 192-bit AES encryption, where previously it was 128-bit. They actually made some notes in their technical doc about why they didn't go to full 256. They didn't feel like it was required, and 192 gave them better performance, better bang for their buck. I'm sure in the future there will be another amendment where they maybe add stronger encryption, and they add some more encryption authentication headers. So to get into the details, I suppose, they add GCMP 256. So that's a method of encrypted authentication for packets to make them harder to forge. And again, it's not too many drastic changes to the protocol itself, just the option for increased security. On top of the WPA3 changes, though, there are actually two other announcements that are technically separate from that standard, but still really benefit Wi-Fi as a whole. The first one is something called Certified Enhanced Open. So
this is kind of like one of the things we recommend all the time, whether you're connecting to something that supports WPA2 or whatever, is don't connect to an open network without passwords, because there's things like man-in-the-middle attacks. You know, if we're sitting there, if it's an open network, it's pretty easy for us to put up a pineapple, fake the SSID, push three people through it.
Just sniff there traffic. Sniffing traffic out of the air.
If you're on an open network, everything you do, if you're not VPNing, could be wide open. So tell me more about it. This is kind of to solve some of those open network problems, right?
Yeah. So any access point and client that are certified enhanced open can now do something called opportunistic wireless encryption, or OWE. And all this really means is the network itself is still open. You don't need to negotiate a key when you connect to the network, but you can now using a Diffie-Hellman handshake. So it's a method
same
of...
Same as IPsec.
Yeah. A method of many a client other... and a server agreeing on a shared key secretly with no one else able to steal that key.
But tell me about Diffie-Hellman, because I think that will solve one of the problems of open networks, but I think that is an open negotiation, right? So it may not solve all of
them. There's no authentication that goes along with it. So it solves the issue of someone just sitting in a coffee shop with Wireshark sniffing packets out of the air.
Damn, I can't use dsniff to grab all your online passwords.
But it doesn't protect against more sophisticated attacks like man-in-the-middle attacks or rogue access points or evil twins.
So the pineapple still may work.
The pineapple still may work, but a bad guy sitting at a Starbucks.
Did you just give up a little information? Is that why you keep on going to Starbucks at lunch, Mark?
I just like lattes, okay? Someone sitting there just sniffing packets out of the air won't be able to steal your unencrypted web connections if you still don't use a VPN.
So that sounds pretty cool. I mean, I still think I would avoid open networks, but at least you feel a little bit better on them.
It adds a nice little bit of protection. It definitely doesn't solve the problem entirely, but it's a good start to still maintain the usability of open networks. That's why they're there. They're really easy for Starbucks or a coffee shop to set up.
And you said there was a second standard, I mean, not directly associated with WPA3, but came out at the same time, like this enhanced open. What's that all about?
This one is called Easy Connect, Certified Easy Connect. And this is really the next iteration of something called wireless protected setup.
Ooh, that might be bad. It wasn't WPS screwed?
WPS was pretty bad. If you're not familiar with WPS, you've probably seen it on your Comcast or Verizon router. It's a little button you can push
it's
on it.
It's an easy button.
Yeah, it's an easy button. You push that button, you pull up some other device that is compatible with WPS, and it'll just automatically connect
to the
network.
Long story short, if you're not smart enough to figure out a SSID and enter a password manually, it just kind of sets it up for you so you can connect to a new network quickly.
Exactly. The problem was it's actually very easy for the bad guys to exploit the exact same easy setup feature to connect to your network automatically as well. Easy Connect adds some better protections to that. We'll get into some of the security implications as well at the end, though. So one of the things that it adds is it allows you to use a mobile device or another access point or something that they'd label as a configurator to add devices to the network. And you add it by scanning a QR code on that device.
That's easy.
Whether it be your camera, your printer.
Sticker on the APs, probably. Yeah.
And then your Easy Connect certified device will automatically pair with that, whatever you're trying to add, your camera, printer, whatever, and then configure access to the main wireless network for you. So it lets you hook into devices that might not have a GUI, a UI, and set them up to connect to a wireless network just by scanning a barcode and entering some things on your phone.
Well, that sounds easy. I will say one of my predictions, I can't remember if it was 2 years ago, but we don't have Wi-Fi predictions a lot because, you know, we don't see Wi-Fi. There's plenty of attacks man in the middles, but they haven't changed much. But back when the WPS came out and had some major issues, one of the predictions we had at WatchGuard was the next big Wi-Fi issue might have to do with one of the mechanisms, because at the time, Microsoft was doing another similar thing that made it easier to connect to Wi-Fi. By the way, I guess now that crack came out, we can say that that prediction was wrong, because actually it was a pretty deep protocol flaw. But nonetheless, this is one of those easy mechanisms. Now, yeah. I suspect it's probably more secure after the WPS stuff. QR codes, there's user authentication products. There's a lot of products that can use QR codes, but still have good encryption seeds and still have a secure process. But it will be interesting to see once more of the industry starts hammering at these new standards, if they can find any holes in them.
Yeah.
And I would suspect this one might be more vulnerable than some of them.
I could see maybe someone using a phishing attack to convince you into like scanning some other barcode. Oh, yeah. Maybe.
There you go. Like, or even the classic QR code sticker. If you're like in a Starbucks that puts these so their guests can connect, you can just put a sticker of a different one there that points to your pineapple, and now you've man in the middle of them.
So this one's probably going to come down to how it's implemented within the configurator, so your mobile phone or whatever app you're using to set up these devices, and then just your ability to not scan random barcodes and add them to your wireless network, which hopefully you weren't going to do anyway. So there are some great benefits with these. This is going to really help with the explosion of IoT, I think. Having an easy way to add them to a wireless network without using WPS is going to be great.
Yeah.
WPA3 as a whole for that standard, it's got some great improvements, especially for the non-enterprise networks.
Looks more secure for sure.
Yes. And then Enhanced Open, I mean, it doesn't solve all the problems, but it does at least add a little bit more protection than was otherwise available.
But still VPN, man in the middle,
still
possible. Still
VPN and HTTPS wherever you can.
So I think the last question, you know, you might have is, we're talking about WPA3. When's it really coming? From what I understand, the Wi-Fi Alliance has already started the certification process for new products. So they are certifying people like Qualcomm and all the chip manufacturers, Cisco. They're all probably passing products through that. And from what I've kind of read, they expect devices supporting WPA3 to come out later in 2018. The one thing I'm not sure is whether or not this needs a new device to get it, or if some old devices might be able to get a firmware update that gets it. But really, this is probably a late 2018 thing. You don't have to worry about it quite yet, but expect to see at the end of the year new devices rolling out supporting
this. I'm sure
this.
We'll see new ones coming out. If we look back in the history, WPA2 was technically announced in 2004, but we didn't really see it start to take off till 2006. I'm sure this time around, though, it'll be much quicker in terms of adoption,
yeah.
Especially because we have already seen the protocol itself broken with crack.
Yeah.
So,
and I guess it depends, though. I've seen, like I said, definitely new products will come out to support it. It is a little up in the air if firmware updates. So I suspect if it turns out a lot of old products don't do firmware updates, that could slow the adoption just because it's rip and replace. Yeah. So it just depends on whether you're in the camp of expecting some products to receive a firmware update. But I have also read some don't expect devices to receive them. So
something
I guess
to watch
we'll
out for, though.
Yeah.
So, cool. Yeah, cool. So for today's main section, we're going to be discussing nation state attacks. And really, one thing I want to bring up before we dive right in is every year WatchGuard does these predictions for the year of the different cybersecurity incidents or trends that we expect to see throughout the year. One of the big ones we made in 2017 was that civilians would become casualties in what we call the cyber cold war. Corey, this is one of your predictions. Yeah, you want to explain it?
And I probably should explain it because you hear civilian casualties and you think deaths. But if you read the prediction, the first part of that is a cyber Cold War, which is all about nation states, the U.S. government, China, Russia, the U.K., Brazil, all of the Five Eyes.
That Russia place?
That Russia. The election hackers?
Yes, China.
Hacksaws. Anyways, tons of nation states have red teams now. Besides just defending against cyber attacks, it's very clear that they're creating offensive capabilities. And one of my worries there is one of the offense capabilities is using zero-day exploits. I mean, in the cyber Cold War, the weapon of choice is a software vulnerability that no one, including the vendor, knows about. So I'm kind of against nation states stockpiling these zero days if they're in civilian well-known software. And for even the U.S. government or the Israeli or U.K. government, they're looking for flaws in Windows and Mac and iPhones. And so the whole prediction was the cyber Cold War is going on right now, whether you believe it or not. They're stockpiling these issues. But one day, somehow, either a bad guy was going to learn of one of these zero-days himself, or they would somehow get out. And that zero-day vulnerability will be used to attack normal private companies, normal civilians, and it will hurt civilian casualties.
And back in 2017, when we made this prediction, it took about, 3 months for it to start unraveling and becoming
five-ish May. Well, I guess 3 months you might be referring to. There was a leak, yep, probably around March, April. I think it was late April, where I think they called it CIA's Vault 7 leak. And one of the CIA organizations that had access to things like all the Eternal Blue and many other vulnerabilities.
That was actually the separate leak.
Oh, you're right. That's Shadow Brokers. Yes. I'm sorry, Shadow Brokers.
Two separate leaks.
NSA leaks. There's so many freaking leaks, it's hard to keep track of them. But that's kind of the whole point. In the NSA leak, they leaked Eternal Blue and many other Windows SMB vulnerabilities. And then another prediction hit, which was a ransom worm. We predicted a worm that would spread on its own. WannaCry came out, and it leveraged one of these leaked vulnerabilities. Not quite a zero day, because the leak happened, I think, early enough that Microsoft had just patched it like 3 weeks before.
And of course, everyone is really great at keeping their systems updated.
That's
right?
Why WannaCry was a blip on the radar. Yeah. No one got that.
No one.
Certainly didn't cause $4 billion of damage.
The NHS down, stayed MERS, up the
NHS,
whole time.
Yeah. No patients diverted.
God.
So I think we got a double whammy there. We got our ransomware, but we definitely got, I mean, this is kind of why I'm really against nation states holding on to zero day. Now, I'm not naive. I love our intelligence agencies. I think they perform a very good duty for countries. But I think there's one, red teams. There's all kinds of other human attacks, normal attacking OPSET, social engineering, phishing. There's tons of ways they can actually get into their adversaries' networks. And I think they'll do more good by, when they find these zero days, patching them aggressively, especially for their country, so that they can't be used. So I think the idea of holding zero days rather than fixing them so no one, including other nation states, can exploit them, that's my personal belief here.
That's pretty fair. But nation state attacks, especially in the cyber realm, have been around for quite a while, right?
Yeah, it's taken a while for these to evolve. I mean, now that we see them in the open with results of WannaCry and these type of leaks is new, but they did happen in the early aughts. We started seeing signs that more and more nation states were taking advantage of the cybers.
The cybers.
We're here in Baltimore right now, and the cybers are definitely a topic of conversation in the DC area.
Is your kid the one that's good at the cybers?
I don't know. Does watching YouTube videos of Let's Play mean you're good at cybers? In either case, if you're a security guy, you might be like us. We feel like we need to take a drink and sigh every time we hear cyber. Well, moving on.
Yeah, so they've been around for a while. I mean, we saw them, Estonia in 2007, I think?
That's kind of my argument. I think that's the first time it started to leak out to the public. By the way, I have a theory that nation-state attacks probably started behind the scenes long before we knew about it. But a long time ago in Estonia, I won't go into all the political history, but obviously Estonia is a separate country now from Russia. But Russia definitely, has interests there. And Estonia has a huge Russian population. And I believe there was a statue of a Russian soldier, which they were considering to taking down, kind of similar to some of this.
Moving it. In fact, they did move it.
Exactly. Similar to Confederate flags and general statues here in the U.S. now. But as they were taking it down, you know, the local Russian population was very against this. They went on, you know, blogs and forums and argued about it. And there's a lot of rumors of real, you know, government Russian actors kind of riling this up. And basically, a huge DDoS attack affected Estonia. And it started with what we used to call a meat bot, because it started on these forums where people were sharing command line tools, HPing with very specific IP addresses and commands that non-technical people could use to start DDoSing Estonian government sites and stuff like that. But later on, they kind of crowdsourced enough money to rent botnet time, and they did a real DDoS. And it was weird, because I think Estonia may not have been well known to a lot of U.S. citizens in 2007. I think it was like a joke in a Dilbert comic where Estonia, that's like backwards. They have no technology. They live, and it couldn't be further from the truth. Estonia is one of the most technologically advanced countries. You know, a lot of their infrastructure is new. They were one of the first people to do almost 90% or more online banking. They do a lot of online voting. So a DDoS for them really affected their economy. There are situations where they couldn't get gas. They had trouble going to ATMs. So it was a very, very big attack. And because of the actual Russian government kind of stirring on the local Russian population, it was kind of considered one of the first a nation-state attack.
And actually had an effect. Estonia is a member of NATO, and they actually created the, CCDCOE, the Cooperative Cyber Defense Center of Excellence. So I guess NATO has a bunch of different centers of excellence for different topics to help educate and provide R&D for their member states. And Estonia, in the city that had the statue that they moved, actually started the first Cooperative Cyber Defense Center of Excellence.
I actually remember Black Hat way back, I think it was probably 2009, 2010, a guy named Gadi Environ, I believe. He was a CERT guy that came to Estonia and helped fight the DDoS attack. And I just remember being fascinated by his talk.
Must have been a great talk.
Yeah, it was very interesting.
And of course, Estonia may have been the first, or at least one of the first well-known ones, but it's probably not the most high-profile example that everyone's heard of.
Yeah, to me, Pandora's box is what you were getting to.
Yeah, Stuxnet.
Yeah.
So it was, what, late 2009? It was probably around when it was being developed.
2010
when maybe it was discovered.
Actually, that's interesting, because it turned out, you know, if you believe, no American or Israeli government sources admitted to it.
Oh, but never going to.
Exactly. Back in 2006, 2007, the Bush White House actually started something called the Olympic Games Operation, which was creating basically a cyber weapon to screw with uranium enrichment. So it may have been started. In fact, there's even signs of source code in other operations by other actors. You pointed out one, the Equations group that Kaspersky did some research on, that actually are very similar to what was found in Stuxnet. But to me, Stuxnet was the Pandora's box, especially for this nation-state zero-day stockpiling. We probably don't have time to talk about how complex this malware was, but you know, when the 56-page semantic and German research paper came out on this, it was fascinating. For zero-day. I mean, if you guys know about zero-day, a zero-day exploit is like, it's money on the internet. I mean, there's now places that buy them for millions of dollars. Bad guys, real criminal actors, are not going to burn a zero-day unless it's a big deal.
Got to be a high-profile attack.
Exactly. One piece of malware having four different zero-day vulnerabilities, that's still, to this day, I believe, a record. It had all kinds of cool things, like, you know, although it infected Windows, it was looking for very specialized software. I think it was, you know, Simmons Step 7
software.
Yeah, which most people probably never heard of unless they work at some sort of utility or industrial. But it wasn't actually targeting that software, other than it knew there was an engineer that could go and update the firmware of a programmable logic controller on a centrifuge.
Yeah, it jumped from basically traditional computers to, I mean, I guess early day IoT.
Exactly. And not much malware. I mean, even some of today's IoT attacks are attacking Linux systems, and they're not custom IoT attacks. They're very, you know, run-of-the-mill computer Linux system attacks.
This one is about as custom as it gets.
Exactly. I mean, these threat actors, the U.S., had to
allegedly
had to buy this equipment and test this crap out. So it was cool stuff, I guess bad stuff in some ways, but pretty fascinating.
Depending on who you're rooting for. Yeah.
And also rootkits, right? I mean, rootkits were new. Not only did this infect a PLC, but it was the first PLC rootkit in that in manufacturing, there's like a human interface device or a SCADA equipment that monitors all these sensors and centrifuges and stuff. The rootkit would hide the fact that the centrifuge wasn't spinning properly, and it would actually falsify the data,
yeah, as it rips itself apart.
Yeah, it's scary as heck. It in some sense, it's badass if you're a security researcher and you're fascinated by the stuff. But it was Pandora's box. You know, this was never meant to go public. This had kill switch stuff. So when it got past just that, was it Nantes, the uranium facility, and it got to the public, now the whole world knows that allegedly a nation state is doing this. And I think at that point, it was like domino effect. Every single nation state started collecting zero day, and it became, I won't say acceptable, but kind of for espionage intelligence, acceptable to do these kind of attacks on a global level now, which is kind of scary to me.
Yeah. And nowadays, these nation state attacks are actually starting to be used a lot more politically now, too. Not necessarily going after government resources, but going after the people of countries now.
Absolutely.
We're seeing this now to this day. With the groups that are called, it depends which researcher you go with. They're either Fancy Bear or Cozy Bear. I think it's FireEye that calls them APT-28, APT-29. Yeah. Microsoft calls one of them Strontium. They have a whole bunch of different names, but
I like the bears because we've been picking on U.S., maybe Israel, and this is a different country. I think this bear might tip it off.
Yeah. So Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear are allegedly two hacking organizations sponsored by Russia, basically. And they've had quite a bit of activity recently. You probably are quite familiar with the attacks recently, hacking into the DNC to steal emails. But that's not the only thing they've done. There's been evidence they've gone after Putin foes in Ukraine. They've gone after Russian opposition in other states as well. They've gone after U.S. private companies, defense contractors that work with the government. And they're actually quite fascinating reading all the write-ups about some of their attacks.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they use a mix of just good old-fashioned spear phishing, but then highly sophisticated payloads to stay on networks.
Yeah. The persistent part of advanced persistent threat. One of the ones I love, by the way, that the French TV channel, like
TV,
I remember
Five Monde.
Exactly. I remember back in the day when we had TV over the air, you know, TV hacking was basically radio piracy. But now that TV is all digital, you know, it's, you haven't really seen a TV channel's broadcast get overtaken until that TV Five Monde attack.
Yeah, it was back in 2015. And to fast forward the fallout of this, I think it was the director of the station actually said there were a few hours of basically being ruined permanently. Fancy Bear and or Cozy Bear were able to take over the broadcasting for the station. They took over their Facebook, their website, their Twitter account, and they posted, it was effectively a false flag attack saying that it was ISIS taking it over it at the time, but it caused a huge disruption for several hours to the point where the station was about to lose a lot of contractual obligations and probably fail. Another attack that you might not be familiar with, they actually spearfished the World Anti-Doping Agency right around the Olympics.
I wonder why.
We're not going to go into that one.
Missed a lot of the Olympics, or almost missed one? Never mind.
They managed to steal quite a bit of information from people that work there, which I imagine they use in other targeted attacks that we might not know about now. If you remember back, I think it was 2016, around October, you probably saw Google break one of their traditional 60-day disclosure timelines for a zero day. This one in Windows, they released it quite a bit earlier than 60 days because they saw that it was being actively exploited in the wild. And Microsoft actually came back the next day and said, yes, we're seeing Strontium, which is what they call Fancy Bear, exploiting this out in the wild. Yep. So I guess if we're going to have takeaways for this, mine would be aware of the potential propaganda when it comes to political seasons that foreign adversaries might be putting out. There's incentives for hostile foreign governments to try and sway opinion and they're going to start using cyber attacks.
We don't care your politics one way or the other, but it is clear. I do believe strongly in when seven different intelligence agencies say that this sort of stuff happened. While it is hard to attribute things, these agencies are good at following tools, tactics, and procedures. And all of them agree that nation states, in fact, allegedly Russia, they're very clear, which is not often. I mean, a nation state usually doesn't point a finger at a country. So when they do that very clearly and there's so much agreeance, that's unusual.
And it's important to point out that this time they help one side. If their goal is just to sow chaos, next time maybe they'll help the other side.
And the funny thing is, like, Stuxnet fascinates and scares me by its power, but I think this quiet propaganda is even more dangerous because it's not overt, but it can affect things. So I think a great tip to look out for this for sure.
Yeah.
And while you're looking out for things, by the way, one thing we mentioned, I think it's around 91% of targeted attacks, which are usually the type nation states are associated with, start with that phishing or spear phishing email. So it's probably a good idea to just be aware of the latest spear phishing techniques specifically.
Yeah, I agree. Any other takeaways you want to add?
Yeah, I kind of have two, I think. One for sure is, you know, I already kind of said it. I am very against government stockpiling zero day. I understand that maybe some agencies should have offensive capabilities, but I think there's more value in fixing zero day aggressively so your citizens are safe than there are in holding on to it for someone else. Maybe some caveats are a non-common software that citizens don't use, but for the most part, I don't like it. Now, the problem is there's not much we can directly do practically other than make our voice heard. I mean, if you live in a country that's democratic, I don't know how, you know, everyone might be cynical whether or not votes will help get the right people that will be against this type of thing. But use your voice, vote, you know, let your congressperson know that stockpiling zero days, you know, probably not a very good idea. The other kind of piece of advice I want to point out is I strongly believe, like none of our listeners, probably none is probably none is probably too strong a statement, but I would say most of the people out there listening to this right now are not a direct target of nation states. But things like Stuxnet that have leaked to the public, that have shown a lot of new advanced techniques, have accelerated the evolution of criminal malware. Criminal malware, since Stuxnet in the past 8 years, has gotten better and better at evasion, has started using things like rootkits more often, is starting to use some of the persistent tactics to hide on computers. So even if you're not a target of nation-state malware, you need to realize that criminal malware has evolved because of these things leaking to the public. So that means your defenses have to evolve. You might hear me and Mark talk all the time about advanced malware protection. Signatures aren't enough. If you had the podcast asked about our security report, most malware gets past signature-based protection. So for this type of thing, you really need advanced malware protection. Use whatever you have, but if you're a WatchGuard customer, obviously APT Blocker and Threat Detection Response are products we use that help with this type of
thing. And you make a great point. I can't imagine many people listening to this podcast are directly targeted by Fancy Bear, Cozy Bear, the NSA, what have you.
You have that Ransom Bear, Fancy Bear dude on your desk. I hear he's sending you ransomware all the time.
Yes, probably. But just because you're not targeted by these nation-state government-backed organizations doesn't mean you're not going to be a victim of them.
Yep.
I almost guarantee that you probably know someone or some organization that was a victim of WannaCry.
Absolutely.
Or something else that used the Eternal Blue vulnerabilities. So just because you're not a target of the first one doesn't mean you're not going to be collateral fallout from the end. That's it for this week. If you like the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review us. You can find me on Twitter at @XORRO_, and Corey is @SecAdept. Again, please reach out to us if you have any questions or topic recommendations for future episodes. And as always, if you need your daily fix of security news, insights, videos, or in-depth research, go to secplicity.org. Thanks again for listening. See you later.